You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy Lend Lease, our summer 2019 podcast spinoff. We're recording this on Bastille Day, July 14th, 2019. And our topic for this week's episode is about piracy. We're going to be talking about some various geographical areas of the world and historical periods of piracy and some of the many political dimensions related to that. There were a number of books that Nate read in particular that, kind of inspired us to do this. So Nate's going to talk about some of the sort of golden age of piracy and Atlantic piracy. Rachel's going to talk about some of the East Asian and Southeast Asian piracy, I think. And then I'm going to talk about Mediterranean piracy. So Nate, let's start with you. What are these two books that you've been reading?
Well, I guess before we get on that, I guess we sort of have been wanting to do this episode for a little while just based on sort of the general interest in the period. And also we've been playing a lot of Sea of Thieves, which is, pirate based, and it's fun to sort of reflect on that as I was reading these books, Republic of Pirates by Colin Woodard, who we like, and The Many-Headed Hydra, Sailors, Slaves, Commoners, and the Hidden History of the Revolutionary Atlantic by Peter Linebaugh and Marcus Rediker, who are sort of big names in the field of Atlantic history, which is a sort of interesting historical angle to explore sort of the cross-Atlantic exchanges and various ways that this sort of period during, early colonialism in the Americas, led to this interchange where you had slaves going across and, people meeting Native Americans and oftentimes finding themselves all aboard the same ship. So that's sort of where this all starts from.
So what is the period that is the golden age of piracy? And then we can work backward to talk about stuff that sort of preceded that leading up to that and then kind of the end of that period as well.
Right. So golden age piracy is what we, normally think about when we're thinking about pirates, where it's, Pirates of the Caribbean and all of that. And, your classic tales of Blackbeard and whatnot. But, of course, you had Spanish colonialism in the Americas in, around 1600s there. So it really started picking up around then. There's debate, of course, historically what the actual golden age is, but sort of agreed that it's had a couple different periods in between the 1650s and the 1720s. There was first the buccaneering period where there were Anglo and French ships based in the Caribbean, so oftentimes, Jamaica, Tortuga, those islands, and they were attacking these treasure ships or Spanish colonies and getting a lot of the valuable minerals like silver that was coming from the Potosi mines and similar things like that. So oftentimes it's in the Pacific as well, so it's not just in the Atlantic. There's a lot of, these massive treasure ships are going around. And there was also a period in the 1690s where there was pirates going out as far as sort of the Indian Ocean and trying to attack ships maybe from the Dutch East India Company or the Mughal Empire, which were often very laden with various spices or silks or things like that. And then, of course, there's the period after the War of Spanish Succession where things basically sort of explode in the Caribbean because there were a lot of these Anglo sailors or former privateers left basically unemployed or their working conditions got a lot worse. So they basically all decided to be pirates. And then eventually the British government had to, basically bring the hammer down on them eventually. But there was a period there where they sort of created their own pirate republic. They had sort of confederations, the Flying Gang and other types of things. So that's sort of what we normally think of when we think of, piracy and all that.
Yeah, and the Stars show Black Sails takes place in that period and location, that immediate aftermath of the War of Spanish Succession. And that's all, I mean, it's a fictionalized thing because it's also a prequel series to the events of the fictional narrative Treasure Island. But it, is basically you have this island where there's various pirates that are trying to think bigger and potentially, you know, declare independence and create their own self-government and so forth, and then are essentially, you know, smashed by the British Navy. And then, you know, Nate, you mentioned about the Pirates of the Caribbean franchise, a whole like core element of that franchise is this notion that there are not that many pirates left and most of them have been destroyed by the British Navy, which are typically presented as villainous figures in the franchise. You know, and that these are these sort of last remnants of pirates trying to make a stand of saying like, we're free men with self-governance and we elect our captains and things like that. And, you know, we live by a code. And some of this is obviously just, you know, fictionalized pop cultural elements that have been around for, you know, a couple hundred years now in various, you know, books and then eventually TVs and movies. But there is some sort of elements of it that are true. And I think you wanted to talk some more about that as well.
Right. Well, you know, sort of in the historical record, there are plenty of examples of captains being voted out. You know, not necessarily a full mutiny or whatever, but just they lost the confidence of the crew. So they're no longer the captain. And oftentimes the captains would only take maybe 1.5 share compared to 1 share for the crew. And maybe like 1.25 or something for their like first mate and whatnot. So it was relatively egalitarian, especially compared to merchant shipping, which conditions were often extremely brutal. You had a lot of people impressed into service, most of whom, you know, I think there was some statistic in the book here, 3 out of 4 of the impressed British sailors died. So it seemed like piracy was in many respects a better option. And I want to read a little bit from the Many-Headed Hydra here, just talking about the term hydrarchy, which was employed a lot in the book, and basically using it as a representation of like the proletariat of the sailors, which is, and being a sailor was, you know, not a prestige job, and was basically people compared it to being a prisoner in many respects. Right, as the strong hands of Brathwaite sailors made the Atlantic a zone for the accumulation of capital, they began to join with others in faithfulness or solidarity, producing a maritime radical tradition that also made it a zone of freedom. The ship thus became both an engine of capitalism in the wake of the bourgeois revolution in England and a setting of resistance, a place to which and in which the ideas and practices of revolutionaries defeated and repressed by Cromwell and then by King Charles escaped, reformed, circulated, and persisted. The period between the 1670s and the 1730s marked a new phase in the history of Atlantic capitalism, one in which the breakthrough discussed in the previous chapter was consolidated and institutionalized amid geographically expanded class struggles. So, you know, ignoring the previous chapter stuff, basically, you know, you have the English Civil War and you have all of these upheavals that have resulted in that, and then the Restoration. So a lot of these sailors have been either, you know, politically persecuted, or in many respects, they felt like they had no longer any access to land or just any sort of future. So that played into a lot of this year.
Now, you wanted to talk specifically about some of the influence of this land issue on people, I guess, going into piracy, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of talk about, you know, there's the historic Putney debates and a lot of stuff coming after the English Civil War, where there were those very much on the side of, there, I guess it was Thomas Rainborough, but very much on the side of, you know, anti-impressment. A lot of there was opposition to slavery in that period as well. You have these sort of radical groups like the Diggers and the Levelers. And, you know, this was sort of like the early resistance to the arrival of capitalism in England. And this is sort of the tradition under which a lot of these piracy types come out of. You know, not everyone, of course. There are a lot of pirates who are just, you know, opportunistic, and they were just doing it because they, you know, didn't necessarily have to obey the laws, or they wanted money. And a lot of times people went back to being either privateers or non-pirates if they could be bought off, or just the opportunities were better elsewhere. So, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of these examples where, you know, pirates would set up, you know, a little colony, or they had hubs around Nassau, At one point, there was a hub in North Carolina for Blackbeard, and then I guess the colonial governor was actually sympathetic in some cases, and other colonial governors were sympathetic to the pirates because they would bring in coin to the colony. So in many respects, they were doing the colonists a favor. But although at one point the governor of Virginia was fed up with Blackbeard, so there was some intercolonial conflict there, and eventually Blackbeard was killed. So, you know, a lot of these pirates didn't make it out alive. They were hung. Some, of course, did, maybe escaped off to like Madagascar or whatever, and were able to sort of live out their days there. But yeah, there were eventually the British, as you mentioned, Bill, sort of the villains in this, sending the Navy to combat the pirates, to like take over Nassau, for example, or just offer like a pardon, basically like, oh, if you were a pirate before, just stop being a pirate and it's fine. And that won over a lot of people because the pay was better at that point. So, yeah, that's eventually how the sort of the golden age was smashed. But there, I mean, piracy still continued, and it's not like they were able to completely control the seas. But I think eventually the British fleet clamped down on them enough. But yeah, so one last passage here, and then we should probably talk about some other things. But the sailors' hierarchy was defeated in the 1720s, the Hydra beheaded, but it would not die. The volatile serpentine tradition of maritime radicalism would appear again and again in the decades to come, slithering quietly below decks, across the docks, and onto the shore, biding its time, then rearing its heads unexpectedly in mutinies, strikes, riots, urban insurrections, slave revolts, and revolutions. And then, of course, you know, it goes on to discuss how the influence of this sort of free-willing spirit probably did have an effect for the various, you know, 18th century revolutions, which kicked off in the colonies and in France. So that's maybe we should talk about some other areas of the world and maybe come back. There are some other influential pirates I could potentially mention, but there's a lot of ocean all around the world. So maybe we should talk about the Mediterranean or some Asian pirates or others.
Sure. Yeah. I guess, Rachel, we'll go to you next. Obviously, there is still pretty active piracy today in certain, key hot points, channels, and so forth in, off the coast of Africa, and then the Straits of Malacca in Southeast Asia. And certainly piracy has been for a very long time an active issue in the whole sort of, you know, Southeast Asian archipelagos and so forth. But you're going to talk to us about some more historical Asian piracy. Where do you want to start on that?
Yeah, so kind of continuing with this historical piracy theme, I just wanted to highlight like one of the most famous woman pirates. Her name is Ching Shi. That's not her real name. It translates to Widow of Ching. She was seized as the bride of a pirate, Ching, and after he died, she took command of the Red Flag's fleet. And she kind of used those beginnings to consolidate power and grow the fleet, and it became hugely successful. She took on her husband's first mate, Cheng Pao, as her own husband, and then installed him as the head of the fleet. That way she kind of moved in the background and had the figurehead, Cheng Pao. He was widely respected among all the pirate fleets, so it was kind of a savvy move on her part. She was known for establishing kind of a really strict pirate's code. She is the only one that could okay attacks. If you disobey, you're beheaded. You give all the loot to your superior, who distributes it afterwards. Disobey once, you're beaten. Disobey twice, you're dead. If you rape a female captive, that's a death sentence right there. If you want to have sex with a female prisoner, you have to take her as her wife and then be faithful to her and treat her well, or else you're beheaded. And she kind of used some spin. She commanded her fleet to not use the word plunder, instead say transferring shipment of goods, because it sounded nicer. So she kind of... She had this strict code, and it worked really well. She even was able to escape a trap that the Chinese government sprang for her in 1809. They got blockaded in a bay, and the authorities laid siege to the pirates for 3 straight weeks with an overwhelming amount of firepower. They sent suicide boats loaded up with straw and explosives that they set on fire and launched at the pirates. But the pirates were able to extinguish the flames, repair the ships, and incorporate them into their fleet. And in the end, they only lost 40 people and not a single ship. The leader of this government expedition falsified the reports to make himself look better and later committed suicide in shame. And the interesting twist to her story is she actually got to retire and got like a pension from the Chinese government. They canceled all the warrants for her, and then they actually made Chang Pao a lieutenant in the Chinese Navy. And one of his first acts was using the government forces to destroy their old pirate rivals. Qing Shi got to spend her final years running a brothel and gambling den, and she died a wealthy and widely respected woman at age 69.
Nice.
So that's pretty impressive. I like reading the stories about the women pirates that kind of are able to grab power and work their magic behind the scenes. So I thought that was a really interesting story. But it's not just Chinese pirates operating in the Pacific. There were a lot of white pirates as well that kind of took advantage of like the opium wars and were really involved in like smuggling opium outside of China. One of the more famous ones is Eli Boggs. He was one of the last active ocean-going pirates operating off the coast of China during the 1850s. He was based near Hong Kong, which was owned by the British after the First Opium War. So he constantly raided outgoing clipper ships carrying highly valuable opium cargo throughout the decade. And he was particularly known for his cruelty. In one recorded incident, he had the body of a captured Chinese merchant cut into small pieces and then had those pieces delivered to shore in small buckets as a warning against interference in his criminal activities. In 1857, after a violent and bloody siege, he was forced to swim ashore after his junk was destroyed by rival pirates. And then he was finally apprehended and imprisoned in a Hong Kong jail for 3 years, eventually being tried for murder before his deportation to the United States. He was also known as being kind of quite beautiful, which belied his cruelty. So it's kind of an interesting story about how these colonists really took advantage of the colonies that they were acquiring at this time and behaving badly. Another example is William Bully Hayes. He operated in the South Pacific, and he was really well known for the practice of blackbirding, which is coercing people through deception and or kidnapping to work as unpaid or poorly paid laborers in countries distant to their native land. So he was notorious in the Pacific for recruiting Pacific Islanders to provide labor for the plantations of Tahiti, Fiji, Samoa, and Australia. While there was some voluntary recruitment of Pacific Islanders, the activity predominantly involved kidnapping, coercion, and tricks to entice Islanders onto ships on which they were held prisoner until delivered to their destination. Not the nicest people operating in those days.
I think, though, thematically here, what you can see is, you know, you're talking largely about 19th century piracy, mm-hmm. with these last two examples here, and that, as you say, it functions again as this extension, officially, unofficially, quasi-officially, of the imperial state that they're sort of loosely affiliated to, in much the same way that earlier, you know, you had seen these people be privateering on behalf of a European government or whatever, or closely working with the colonial governors in some cases and things like that. Like, these plantations would not have functioned in the, you know, imperial periphery without this extensive kidnapping of forced labor of these Pacific Islanders and so forth by these pirates.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I would also say that was a big impetus for the British to take down the pirates as they were disrupting this the slave trade coming from the coast of Africa there. So that was cutting into their margins a fair amount.
All right. Well, that actually transitions pretty nicely into the discussion of Mediterranean piracy. which obviously goes back to the ancient period. And again, we're just sort of there's a lot of areas and time periods you could talk about piracy all over the world, so we can't cover all of it, but we're hitting these sort of three large thematic elements here. But Mediterranean piracy, you have the sort of ancient period of Mediterranean piracy and the modern period of Mediterranean piracy, going from, you know, which the in the latter, that would be, we're talking like, let's say, 1400s to the, you know, early 1900s and so forth. A lot of that also had to do with this close relationship with the onshore economies and this and the slave trading. There was, especially in the ancient world, but also in the Barbary piracy period in North Africa, this idea of, you know, capturing people and enslaving them and bringing them to the slave markets becomes this, you know, huge economic source. And, you know, some governments would be encouraging it because they were making money off of it, but some governments were resenting it because it was interfering with their own operations, some of which, as you know, Nate was just alluding to, was the slave trade itself, right? If the piracy benefited their slave trade, that was good. If the piracy interfered with their slave trade, that was bad. But they didn't particularly have a problem with the slavery inherently. So let's talk about ancient Mediterranean piracy. Obviously, the most sort of famous thing that we know about this is Plutarch's section on the life of Caesar, talking about how Julius Caesar was once kidnapped by pirates. He was relatively young at the time, if I remember correctly. I don't have the entire story in front of me, but he was captured by pirates. It says they controlled the sea with large armaments and countless small vessels. The pirates demanded 20 talents for his ransom. Caesar laughed at them for not knowing who their captive was, and of his own accord agreed to give them 50 talents instead of 20 talents because he said he was worth more than that, sort of cementing his legend as a really arrogant, guy who could command any room, so to speak. And then it said in the next place, presumably where they landed, he had sent various followers to various cities to procure the money for the ransom and was left with one friend and two attendants. He held them in such disdain that whenever he would lay down to sleep, he would send them an order to stop talking, even though they were murderous pirates who were constantly threatening to kill him. So he was held for 38 days and began treating this is again according to Plutarch's rendering of this, so who knows if it's true, but he began treating his captors as if they were a royal bodyguard that was there to protect him rather than holding him prisoner. And he would call them illiterate barbarians and threaten to hang them all while laughing. The pirates thought this was hilarious because, you know, that's a weird thing to do if you're a captive, but again, did not understand who he was or that he might be able to bring some force to bear on them if he was actually released, and they probably regretted releasing him eventually. So the ransom finally arrived, and he was released. He immediately went around hiring a bunch of vessels to go to sea and hunt down the people that had been holding him prisoner. He took them all captive, brought them ashore. There was a local governor that said, I have to figure out what to do with them. But, you know, you can keep an eye on them, and didn't realize that he was just going to go rogue, essentially, and crucified all of the pirates. So this is sort of one of the more famous like anecdotes about ancient Mediterranean piracy from the late classical Roman period. But this was something that had stretched back for thousands of years before this. And the Mediterranean sort of geography played a huge role in this. The onshore economies often struggled a lot because, you know, a lot of the land, especially in sort of the areas around like Greece, was not particularly good, especially along the coast. So, you know, Greece, we know, had a lot of, you know, they had the orchards and so forth. But beyond that, they weren't like growing a lot of cash crops. They were often, shepherding and things like that. And it was just not very good land. So a lot of people, out of sort of necessity and the fact that the geography was beneficial to piracy, turned to this. So shipping raids, you know, which would be a ship hunting down another ship, pulling it over, and then, you know, maybe taking the crew prisoner or just stealing the treasure or whatever, as well as raids on land were both very common. There were a lot of convenient places where you could hide a ship in the Mediterranean, either, you know, if you needed to make repairs or whatever, you needed to hide from someone chasing you down, or if you wanted to make a break, you know, out, you know, you'd have someone on patrol on the cliff or whatever, and then say, oh, there's a, you know, merchant vessel coming by, let's go get it. So piracy became this huge source of economic activity. And again, I mentioned earlier about the slave trade. Many people, especially when their local economies would take a really big bad downturn, would go join piracy because, you know, as Nate talked about in the later period, right, there were, if you got desperate, this was a cheap, quick way that you could onboard into a new job, right? There wasn't a lot of interview process probably for that. And it got so bad that a lot of cities had to relocate their populations inland away from their, you know, natural harbors, and then connect often a long set of walls to connect the actual harbor and dockyard areas to the actual urban core. Athens, obviously the most famous example of this, which becomes very key during the war with Sparta when they end up under siege because the Spartans realized that they could cut off the access to the port. But they had eventually had to, in order to protect people from getting raided, had to move their population inland, you know, hundreds or thousands of years earlier. As happened in the later period, you would have these sort of proto-privateers in some cases, people being mercenary navies for acting on behalf of specific governments. But of course, that was much more common later on. Many of the ships had some kind of democracy or quasi-democracy in this period, often influenced by someplace like Athens or one of the other Greek city-states that had relatively participatory, we'll call it, forms of government, even if they weren't necessarily democratic per se. And of course, that's something that you see in a lot of these cases. I mean, you can also talk about the Viking Age, which is a comparison that I kept making in my head a lot as I was looking through some of this research, you know, that the Vikings had more egalitarian societies than a lot of their contemporary societies. And the raids tended to be, you know, relatively low level organized if they, you know, in some cases, obviously also you would have kings authorizing them, but, you know, people would sometimes be permitted to just organize their own raiding party. And you would, you know, people would decide to follow you because they thought you were a good leader who could, you know, help get you a lot of loot. Now, a lot of our records of Mediterranean piracy in the ancient world, obviously there's some of these, you know, Greek anecdotes or Roman anecdotes, but a lot of it actually comes from ancient Egypt. We know that the, you know, ancient Egyptian monarchy had extensive record keeping, and, you know, you have the papyrus and the stone carvings and everything and the clay tablets. So they actually exchanged hundreds of correspondences that we still have between the Egyptian monarchy and various foreign monarchies around the region, you know, around the Fertile Crescent and the rest of the Mediterranean, discussing this problem of pirate raids, and especially the Sea Peoples period. That's something that, you know, a lot of people might have heard of, this sort of enigmatic, mysterious group of people from across the ocean that would arrive, and in some cases they were making significant invasions, but in many cases they were just doing sort of Viking style raids where they would land and then, you know, steal a bunch of stuff and people and then skedaddle. But eventually the Sea Peoples sort of collapsed because they sent a significant landing force into Egypt, and the Egyptian army kept falling back and falling back to draw them further inland, and then, you know, took advantage of the fact that they were not well prepared to engage in a serious land campaign, and they won a huge battle over them well inland. One of the biggest features of the ancient Mediterranean piracy, as was the case in many piracies, was this element of speed. You could make a landfall, you could go grab some stuff, you could, you know, take some people hostage, but if you didn't get out of there fast enough, probably someone was going to be able to organize a response, or maybe there was a garrison of troops nearby that could respond to you. And this becomes sort of a larger theme in the issue of Mediterranean piracy in general. And in fact, linguistically, a lot of pirates in the you know, classical era would be referred to in whatever the local language was by whatever your word for thief was, or, you know, a plundering army or something like that, because it tended to be a lot more about these amphibious landings rather than, you know, big sea battles like we would envision from the golden age of piracy. And again, a lot of that makes sense if you think about it, because most ships wouldn't have had a way of engaging each other very easily at the time. Obviously, you know, sometimes you'd have triremes ramming each other and things like that, but that's not really necessarily an accurate reflection of the overall picture. So a lot of it was just easier to do these sort of Viking style raids, and that continued in the Mediterranean, you know, as far into the Middle Ages. And the Vikings themselves came to the Mediterranean, and we're going to talk in just a bit about the Barbary Coast pirates and the Muslim pirates. That was a huge feature of the Mediterranean world as well in that time period. I would also speculate that one of the big sort of changes that transforms what we think of as piracy is the advent of cannons and significant shore defenses. If you had a way of building a huge fort that wasn't just to protect people by putting them inside, but it could also actually, you know, fire on approaching ships, that changes the entire dynamic and probably shifts it more in the direction of these ship-to-ship boarding-style piracy and away from these landing party piracies, which I would say probably helps shift things in the direction that we think of in pop culture from the golden age of piracy compared to this ancient world period. So that essentially brings us up to the Barbary pirate period, which again, you know, there was a significant tradition of these Muslim powers in North Africa and the various Mediterranean islands engaging in piracy against the other Mediterranean islands or the coastlines of the major Mediterranean powers. But the corsairs that we, you know, are sort of most famous are around from, let's say, their sort of peak periods, you know, the 1400s and so on, and then ultimately declining across the 1700s and into the early 1800s. They often served as mercenaries or privateers working on behalf of North African governments or the Ottoman regime in major wars. But they also sometimes worked with Northern European powers. So, for example, a number of corsairs worked very closely with the Dutch during the 80 years long period of the Wars of Independence by the Netherlands against the Spanish Empire. And so they would be attacking Spain from the south, coordinating with the Dutch, who were also famous naval people and, you know, with a merchant navy and a combat navy. And they would be attacking Spain. The other thing is that, you know, as we talked about later on, you had that War of Spanish Succession, which England was heavily involved in and involved a lot of these British privateers. But there was that earlier period, you know, when like Queen Elizabeth was in power. And so there was this period when you had a number of English privateers raiding both the Spanish treasure ships, but also into the Mediterranean because Spain, you know, controlled Naples and so forth as well. And a number of the big Mediterranean islands. But we see the similar problem as what happened after the War of Spanish Succession in this earlier period. So Queen Elizabeth dies, the Stuarts come to power from Scotland, in England, what is later going to be Great Britain, but is still at this point dual monarchy. And they sort of decommission a bunch of these privateers. And we see this similar problem of like, well, now how are these people supposed to make a living? And, you know, they don't really have a lot else going on. So initially, the English tried to impress a bunch of them into naval service. And this did not work out very well for a lot of them. Many of them were not happy to be drawn into this and really resented it. One of the most famous examples is this guy named Jack Ward, who is one of the earliest, within the English tradition, elected captains. So he had been forced, after being a privateer, was forced into naval service, didn't like that. His crew sort of rises up, elects him as captain, and they go head off to the Mediterranean. And he's having a worse and worse and worse relationship with the English government, not because he's really targeting England, but because all of the other governments that he is targeting or the merchant groups that he is targeting blame England for this. And so England is getting upset about it as well. His primary target was Venetian shipping, which was very lucrative at the time. And he eventually gets into such hot water with the English government that he lands in Tunis and converts to Islam with his entire crew. I mean, I don't think he was a particularly observant Muslim. There were contemporary accounts saying that he was pretty much drunk all day. But he continued this raiding with the express permission of the government in Tunis. The leadership there would take up to 10% of the treasure that he had, you know, would recover from, you know, Venetian or maybe Genoese or Spanish ships or whatever. And they would get a huge cut of this. And then, you know, he and his crew could continue to make an enormous amount of money. The other feature that we see is as a result of these involvements in, say, you know, Ottoman operations in the Eastern Mediterranean or North African and even French operations in the Western Mediterranean against the various rivals, you see this geopolitical involvement, this quasi-religious involvement of, oh, we're Muslims against the Christians. We also see that counter-piracy operations start happening by Christian religious orders. A number of them have been part of the Crusades, and then they get forced out of the Holy Land, so where do they go? They're in places like Cyprus or Rhodes, and then subsequently moved to Malta after the fall of Rhodes. And these orders, as well as some on the continent themselves, would organize in two prongs. One would be these, you know, counter-piracy raids where they would go out hunting these North African pirates or Ottoman pirates, and would then sometimes even participate in big naval engagements, especially toward the end of the period. But the other thing is the lines get pretty blurry there, of course, because you can say, well, we're not pirates, we're anti-pirates. But, you know, as Rachel alluded to earlier, if you come up with various euphemisms like we're just transferring the cargo from the pirates, you know, to legitimate ports of business, like that means you're effectively also pirates. You're just stealing from other pirates. The second prong, though, was that a lot of these religious orders would organize basically money collections for ransoms so that there would be a standing pool of money to pay off. Because in many cases, obviously some people were being sold into slavery if they were captured, but in many cases, the Barbary pirates would just hold people prisoner, wait for a ransom, and then sell them back to their, you know, place of origin. And in fact, we start seeing, in addition to the rise of shipping insurance for like storm related things, one of the sort of earlier forms of insurance has to do with anti-piracy insurance, and not just for your cargo, but also for your personnel and people that could potentially be captured. And there was this whole thing that sprang up of, oh, we have to ransom these Christians out of the Muslim prisons in North Africa and so forth. A lot of the focus of this Barbary piracy was, again, either you capture a ship and you take the crew as slaves because you always need crew, especially because these were galley ships that were rowing with oars, so you needed galley crews. Or you would land on, you know, an island or the mainland coast and, you know, kidnap all of the villagers. And this happened as far away as Iceland, not just in the Mediterranean. You would have there was a significant raid by a North African pirate to Iceland. And you would take potentially hundreds of villagers. And obviously, again, some people sold into slavery, but in a lot of cases, they would just be waiting for a ransom to pay them back, and it was very lucrative. We see this, of course, today in the form of, you know, terrorist groups in the Maghreb in North Africa or in some of the conflict zones in Asia, kidnapping foreign aid workers and then ransoming them back for huge amounts of money. And this leads into the whole thing of, you know, should we not negotiate with terrorism? Because, of course, in this period, you can see very clearly that the creation of these large ransom funds did incentivize the continuation of pretty lucrative kidnapping operations. Many of the islands in the Western Mediterranean built very large forts just to try to deter the raids, again, by having a place that people could go hide in. But eventually the decline of Barbary piracy comes, and you can track this. There's an article that I've put in the links that measures the military decline of the Western Islamic world as measured by a declining Barbary ransoms. You see the decline of Barbary piracy beginning as these emerging concepts of nation states like France or Spain or even England begin funding these standing navies with specific anti-piracy ships. And of course, a lot of that had to do with, you know, the English building building these patrol ships for the Caribbean, but these also got deployed to the Mediterranean in the same period. So, you know, at the time, we had these rogue galleys that were not really equipped for naval combat. So their plan was to use, you know, pistols or rifles or, you know, a blunderbuss or something, or just a scimitar. You would board the ship, maybe exchange some fire if they didn't surrender immediately, and that would be the end of that. But you weren't shelling them with your cannons. The occasional exceptions would be people like Jack Ward, who came from this naval artillery background, where they would kidnap, you know, they would capture some Venetian ship or something that did have cannons, and then they could use those in that context. But for the most part, the objective of a Barbary pirate was row as fast as you can, catch up to a ship, board it, steal a bunch of cargo and people, and then run away. They were not really equipped to deal with these anti-piracy frigate patrols that started appearing, and the frigates couldn't necessarily, you know, overtake one of these ships that was running away. But again, that was enough to really stop a lot of this, because they were not prepared to be doing a fight, so they would just, you know, abandon the raid that they were attempting to do and leave the area. So that starts to put an end to that. And the other thing, of course, that we see happen is this very heavy naval bombardment. Once you have cannons that aren't just meant for shelling other ships, but can actually, you know, are mounted on a ship that can attack fortifications, that can lob cannon shots onshore into, you know, these cities themselves, into populated areas, you see the rise of what would later become gunboat diplomacy. So this is the sort of the proto version of that. The European powers and the early American Navy organized these counter raids to in North Africa to stop this. And then there were after this period, finally, in the, you know, sort of early to mid 1800s, you end up having a significant war between France and Algeria, which ended, I think, fairly quickly with the annexation of Algeria, where France was just like, all right, we've completely had enough of this. It's over for the Tunisian and Algerian pirates. We're going to annex the entire area into France. Obviously, they were also doing it for imperialism reasons, but that's sort of the pretext that they used. And the last thing I want to talk about is just one particular famous woman pirate, again, because Rachel brought up the great example from China. So this is a woman who's known as Saida Alhura. That's really more of a title, not her actual name. But she was from Grenada, and the fall of Grenada in the late 1400s happens, and her family flees to Morocco. And she got married to Sultan Al-Mandri in Tetouan, which is an area within sort of the Moroccan region. And this was a, you know, semi-significant small power in the area, and they had various wars with the Portuguese, and she would be the vice governor of Tetouan while her husband was off doing various things. In 1515, he dies, and the city essentially names her the governor, because they already knew her, they were confident with her continued governance, she did a good job, etc. She was then, because she was this power political player, the king of Morocco decided to marry her. So that was her second husband. And this was the last time that a king of Morocco has gotten married outside of the capital, because she refused to leave her city because she saw that as a threat to her sovereign power within her sort of governorate. And so she insisted that he had to come to her to get married. And then she linked up with the Ottoman corsairs, the Barbarossa brothers, and put together this huge fleet and began doing these privateering operations in coordination with the Ottomans. And this was a fairly loose relationship to the Ottomans that even the Barbarossas had. You know, they would privateer around the Western Mediterranean, and this sort of made her the queen of the pirates, so to speak. This is a from the Yemen Times article on this. She kind of especially tended to target the Portuguese and the Spanish, because she had come from Grenada and been expelled by the Spanish, or at least had to flee. And she actually captured the wife of a Portuguese governor in 1520. And her reign continued in this period from 1515, when her first husband died, all the way to 1542. After about 30 years of rule, eventually she was overthrown by her son-in-law and ultimately lost her property and power. But an interesting historical figure in the context of Barbary piracy. Rachel and Nate, I don't know if you guys have any comments on any of this stuff.
I did just want to mention, for like a fictional perspective on the Barbary Pirates, The Baroque Cycle by Neal Stephenson kind of touches on it. One of the main characters, Jack Shafto, gets kind of gang pressed into the Barbary Pirates, and then he kind of works his way up to become like head pirate. So it's kind of a fun like fictionalization of that story.
I guess I just wanted to mention another pirate queen, Grace O'Malley, 16th century Irish pirate queen who sort of lived right on the, I guess, Clare Island on the west coast of Ireland there. And apparently at one point met Queen Elizabeth. Interesting, I guess, some of O'Malley's sons or maybe her brother-in-law had been taken captive, and she had been engaged in anti-English raids and battles in addition to the sort of piracy. And she visited, met with Queen Elizabeth, didn't get the ransom back, but apparently she blew her nose in a handkerchief that was provided to her and then threw it in the fire, which shocked and scandalized the English. But she informed everyone that in Ireland, a used handkerchief was considered dirty and properly destroyed, which I guess kind of makes sense. I don't quite understand the whole tradition, the British tradition of keeping a used handkerchief. But so anyway, Grace O'Malley, yeah, so, and was involved in the 9 Years' War of the Irish resisting the attempts of the English to colonize them. So just yet another example of all sorts of different pirates all around the world.
All right. Well, that was a lot of fun. And, you know, as Nate said, Nate and I certainly have had a lot of fun playing the Sea of Thieves video game over the past year. That's on Xbox and PC. I know, you know, it kind of got off to a little bit of a slow start for some people. And so a lot of people didn't stick with it. But we and some of our friends stuck with it and had a lot of fun. And we've even got Rachel to play a couple times with us. But that's, you know, it's a hard life out there for a pirate, because you can have a big old naval battle and then get no treasure at the end. But anyway, we certainly had a lot of fun with that. And so we've been thinking about doing an episode on piracy for the past year and some of the sort of political and economic dimensions of that. But we didn't really have a good opportunity until this summer. So I was glad that we were finally able to do that. Nate, thanks so much for the idea and for being on this week.
Thanks.
And Rachel, thank you as well.
Thanks, Bill.